and welcome again to Reality Check. This is Jeannie Allen. We have a truly spectacular guest today, Jonathan Harber, and he's with me in the studio at National Review in New York City. Jonathan's online profile describes him as an education entrepreneur, and he's truly that in every sense of the word. Happy to have you, Jonathan.
Wow, thank you, Jeannie. Delighted to be here.
Tell us about your first entrepreneurial enterprise.
Believe it or not, I've started three what you would now call ed tech companies that I've sold to public companies. But the third one was called SchoolNet, which I co-founded with Dennis Doyle. You know Dennis, fabulous man and author. He wrote Reinventing Education with Lou Gerstner. And winning the brain race.
And Lou was the head of IBM at the time, right?
He was the head of IBM, yeah. And then he wrote Winning the Brain Race with David Kearns, former, I guess, deputy secretary.
Yeah, and Xerox.
Education, correct, and CEO of Xerox.
Amazing.
Yeah. I met Dennis, actually, first saw him quoted in the New York Times and then met with him and brought him on, and he helped to consult on some things. And he had made the case to me, why don't I go and speak with public schools, because I was working with the online data and online communications tools for parents and kids. And it seems crazy to me that anyone would do that, meaning go and speak with public schools as a potential business. That being said, we went on a tour, and this was in the late, I guess, mid-90s, and it was the height of the standards movement. So you had states that were writing standards, you had districts writing standards, you had teachers writing standards, all within the same district. Anyway, so we took a tour around the U.S. meeting with superintendents and heard everything from when I would speak with them. And by the way, in Dennis's books, he and Luke Gerstner and David Kearns, they realized this 30, 40 years ago that there was this disparity domestically between our haves and have-nots, and education was the key. And there was a disparity globally between those companies that thrive and those that don't. And education and human capital was the key. And they saw it years and years and years ago. So my eyes were really widened when I saw that or read the books. And when we went and started talking to superintendents, I naively would ask simple questions like, how come some of your low-income kids are not doing as well as other kids? And I'd get responses that would generally start with a chuckle. And then it would either be, are you kidding me? I couldn't tell you how many kids I have, no less who's doing well and who isn't.
Wow.
Or academics isn't my domain. I'm happy to have you speak with your chief academic officer. And can I show you the new football stadium? Because I'm really proud of it. And this was, again, this is 20 years ago.
Right.
So when we think we haven't made any progress, I think if I look back to those conversations, I realize there's not a single superintendent in the country today that doesn't realize that understanding data and understanding where their kids and teachers and schools are performing and where they're not and where they can improve. I think it would be hard to find too many.
Okay, so wait, before you go on, I want to ask you this question, though. You're talking to these superintendents, you're asking these questions. They didn't know anything about really who was in their schools, let alone what their level of education was. That is kind of hard to believe, because now we do have a lot more data than ever before. We've used that data for meaningful impact and policy. So how did you get them to start using data?
Well, actually, they were hungry for it. They were just in disbelief that it was possible. And this was just at the beginning of the internet age. So we founded SchoolNet on the principle that schools could use data in better ways to increase academic achievement. And that turned into a variety of enterprise tools, let's call it, for school district. And again, going back and I always start by asking questions. So I scratched my head and I said, you have this thing called the student information system, don't you? Because kids have to enroll. And they said, of course we do. And then I said, well, in your states, they give tests every year. You have those. Don't you have that data? And they said, they think somewhere there's some CDs that somebody got from the state.
CDs.
Yes.
Remember those?
Time, absolutely. But they said if they wanted to actually ask a question of a subgroup, they would send their data people out or their IT people out, and 6 or 8 weeks later, they would get a response. So they were really in disbelief that when I said to them, would it be interesting to you if from your desktop we could set it up so you could query and ask, you know, how many kids of any particular a subgroup or whatever you're looking for have what scores over what time and what schools? And really that question got such clear, of course I'd be interested, that gave us the raison d'etre to charge forward and say, okay, we're going to build this. And then we found some innovative superintendents who were willing to kind of be the first ones, and SchoolNet was born.
And that was one of the first school information data compilation systems ever, right?
Yeah, we didn't even know what to call it at the time. So student information systems had always existed, and the key was that most things in education had always been created for compliance purposes. So student information systems, general first purpose was, can you make sure you enroll students and take attendance so that report can get to the state? Because assuming that happened, the money came and states and districts were paid. Same thing with the high stakes assessments. Those were really for generally state policymakers to take a look over time, and with sampling mechanisms generally to inform their policies. So these were not really designed for decision support at a district level.
And schools themselves would be able to use this data, presumably, if the information was pushed down to the schools, right?
Oh, absolutely. So from the first time we asked those questions to, you know, fast forward to you know, let's call it 2011, which is when we were eventually acquired, we had over 10 million students data, which was provided in ways where teachers could instantaneously use data to drive daily instruction, to sit down one-on-one with the student, where students could have access to data. The whole notion of formative assessment really took off, meaning not assessment of learning, but assessment for learning, which is what Rick Stiggins coined, and thinking about the feedback of assessment as just being pivotal to any form of learning. And the tighter you could get that and the closer you could get it to the student and the teacher, the better.
You know, I've always said that one of the biggest challenges to improving educational organizations, making things better for all kids, is the fact that we ordinary people don't know enough about what's actually happening in schools. And what you just said, I bet, is a mystery to most people. In other words, that there's this data out there that it's, you know, collected, consumed, utilized, applied to decision making, presumably for better schools, because schools that aren't doing very well usually don't use data very well, right? I mean, how do we help people understand that there's all these things happening out there and that there's actually some benefit to, you know, what's happening in with this data? In other words, you know what I mean? Like, I bet you this is a mystery to people.
Well, every parent is hungry for data on their kids. So I think one of the first things is, the Department of Ed had worked on something. I'm trying to remember what it was called. It was the blue dot or blue label or something. The first thing is that parents should actually be the owners of the kids' data, and data should be transportable, and it should essentially be something that if we think about healthcare, same thing, where your electronic medical record someday, every time I go to a doctor, I just hand them my card,
right,
and automatically that digital data goes into my account, not their hospital's account, and they ask me permission to keep it in their hospital's account. Same thing, I think, should be happening for data, which is that data should belong to the student and the parent. That should be transportable wherever the parent goes. The school should have permission to use that data for educational purposes.
And then they might know a lot more about how their child is doing.
Absolutely, and know what questions to ask. And again, me being someone who, in the industry, it's been somewhat comical because I have three kids of my own. When I've gone into schools and asked for the Dibbles reports for my children and gotten blank stares, and I think the more data parents and kids had access to, the smarter questions. And it's funny how a lot of doctors don't want people to have access to their medical records because they're afraid of what questions they'll ask or conclusions they'll make. But for me, to answer your question, I do believe starting with having open data that is private to parents and students, that certainly would help to educate them more about what data exists, how it can be used, how it can be helpful, how it can be used to help to customize, personalize, tailor the best educational services for their kids. The other answer to your question that I would say in terms of, you know, how do we know about what this data is and how it can be used? Data is definitely a two-edged sword. And even when we talk about assessment, I think we always have to be asking before an assessment, what is the purpose of this assessment? What's
okay,
it going
wait,
to be
you
used
go on.
For?
Assessment versus
yes.
test.
Yes.
What's the difference?
I think assessment is a better general category. We are constantly assessing, period, mm-hmm. in the world. If you are going to be learning and you don't have feedback, it is almost impossible to learn. The only way to get feedback generally is to get assessment. That could be somebody sitting there saying, this is the way you do it, this is the way you don't. But imagine learning how to golf and you take a swing and then your golf instructor says, I'll get back to you in 6 weeks with what you know what you might change.
Right.
Now, that's a little different than if there was, and I don't know, I throw golf. Do you golf?
No, I
fish.
Have.
Fish, if you were fishing.
Tennis,
okay.
But you know I'm not very good at that either. So let's just make believe there's someone else here.
We'll stick with tennis for the moment. So, yes, if you're a tennis coach and giving an instruction, you need to be able to assess immediately and give immediate feedback and let someone make quick corrections. If you were part of the USTA, is that the right?
It.
And you were trying to do an analysis or, you know, on the quality of serving techniques, then it might be a little different usage of data and the assessment might be. So I often think that these are confused and people start getting into questions and discussions about tests and state tests and standardized tests and who's using this and we're doing this test so that teachers can have better data, but generally that gets conflated and it's just very important to always, one, assessment and feedback are good, two, needs to be understood what is the purpose of that data for.
So very much along those lines, you're talking about portability of data. And that presumes that people can actually go somewhere other than the school to which they're assigned, right? So I think you're probably a fan of this notion that parents should be in the driver's seat.
Yes, I think it's key, and certainly as a as a parent of three, I'm always trying to put together the quilt of education for my kids. Some of that is going to be through the school districts that we have offers to. Some of it is through outside services after school. I've got one now applying to college. Some of my kids have needed some special services. And as you know, I also helped to start a charter school. So I'm a big believer in charter schools as well as another choice alternative. So absolutely having being armed with the data on your kids certainly helps you to make better choices.
And you've always been of this philosophy, no matter what your other thoughts or issues or feelings about world and politics, that education is a consumer's, should be a consumer's right, or should be in a consumer, what would you call it?
Well, I certainly think if we look at the founding of this country, that I think free education is, or certainly I guess we have determined from, I guess it's kindergarten till you're 16, I guess,
right.
Is a right and should be provided. And that's something that the government should be making sure exists. Now, I think there are various ways to deliver that education. I know you're a big cheerleader for this topic, which I agree that having multiple options as to how where you send your kids to school. Sometimes that's not possible if you're way out in the in rural part of the world, other than online, which is now giving some other possibilities. Sometimes your choices are limited, but I do tend to believe that the more choice that that you have of high quality, the better off your kids are and families.
And you grew up in New York. You still live in New York. We are talking in September 2018, and I was just reading a piece about how the schools are maxing out on spaces for charters, and yet there's more and more demand for this particular kind of choice in New York. It's actually the only one permitted other than among traditional public schools where older kids and students do get to choose. But there's this fight about, well, we can't really provide more students options because we don't believe in charter schools, really. What's that about?
You're talking about New York State or New York City? Now you're going to test my my legislative lack of knowledge, but I believe the caps are set at the state level,
right?
Not at the city level, and then under the new laws, that districts, assuming parents choose, or if a school is able to get a charter, that it then becomes the district's responsibility to either house that school, or if they can't, to provide a per capita rent allocation. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's the district's purview to determine how many charters there are or aren't.
No, but they're saying that they can't accommodate anymore.
Well, from a space perspective.
Yes.
So, and again, I'm not a space planner. But I do believe that the and by the way, as someone who runs a charter school, that sometimes is advantageous and sometimes not. Mm-hmm. Getting a per capita allocation for rent certainly it seems like another equitable remedy, if you want to call that, or equitable choice, assuming you have a high quality charter that's approved and has a good team. To be given the funds to go and find real estate, it may sometimes be actually preferable as well. And if there is a space available, and actually the charter that I chair is in district space, so in our case the district did actually find capacity available that we're in, and we've had a very good relationship and partnership with the district. We are now in the stages of applying for new one, and we just won't know. Mm-hmm. And some of it has to do with what area you're also in. If you are in a particular area, it's somewhat serendipitous as to whether or not there's excess capacity available where you want to start a school. So anyway, that would be my...
Yes, so it's really intriguing that this notion, sort of the redefinition of education, is happening in cities like this, states across the country, in communities where more and more parents are moving to do something different. Your school that you helped found has an experiential component to it.
Yes.
Which is not traditional.
Yep.
For district schools. What else are you seeing through your ed tech work that is interesting and maybe exciting for people to know about?
Well, you mentioned a couple of things. One, so the school that I chair is called the Launch Expeditionary Learning School, which is based on actually a comprehensive school reform model that was created by Outward Bound, with the notion of trying to take kids outside of themselves, which used to be in the woods and through ropes courses. And again, it was under David Kearns that we had the comprehensive school reform movement, and this was one of the models. And the thought was, can we bring that in from the wilderness into the classroom and create a school environment that challenges kids to go a step farther, that focuses on character building in addition to academic excellence, and creates a whole variety of constructs, for example, crew. And we talk about how students are crew, not passengers. and crew towards their own education. And kids are assigned crew when they first start school. So it's a you're with 8 or 10. It's a little like homeroom, but your crew, and you stay in that crew until you graduate.
And each person in the crew has a role.
Well, each person in the school has a role, and each person in the crew it's somewhat symbolic that you are rowing. You're not viewing. So anyway, I do think that there are interesting innovations in schooling. And by the way, some of the other interesting things about the expeditionary learning model, and there are about 150 expeditionary learning schools, mm-hmm. I think. The notion, and I know that there are a lot of schools that do this now, so I'm not sure when some of these came about, but they're very encoded in the expeditionary learning model. You don't have parent-teacher conferences. You have student-led conferences. So I've sat in, and by the way, our school is in the worst performing district in New York. And I've sat in on fascinating meetings where the teacher did not speak the same language as the parent. And the student is basically presenting their portfolio of work. Their evidence of learning is what it's called. So we have presentations of learning, evidence of learning.
And how old are these students?
These are middle schoolers.
That's pretty ambitious.
And sometimes they're also translating at the same time for their parents who are sitting there asking questions of them so that the teachers understand what the conversation is. And it is just fascinating.
That's really neat. So speaking of that, and that's one of those innovations that wasn't born of tech, right? Mm-hmm. So I've talked a lot on this program. I've had people in the technology field. We are part of Start Ed Together. You were kind enough to ask me to help you on that endeavor. Tell us about Start Ed and how tech now is bringing more innovations to schooling.
Sure. Well, first, StartEd is it's a public benefits corporation that was founded on the notion that if we look from early childhood to corporate training and lifelong learning, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of gaps, thousands of problems, thousands of opportunities. And it's not going to take any one company. It's not going to take any one entrepreneur, but it's going to take an army of EdTech entrepreneurs to wrestle with, grapple, pick up these challenges. And I do believe that using the form of a corporation is a fantastic way of trying to solve some of these challenges.
It's so, like a public-private partnership in a way.
Yeah. So with that as a mission, and you did mention before, we have partnered with NYU, but we essentially aim to recruit and develop great entrepreneurs in the education and ed tech world. And by the way, ed tech is often can be misunderstood as to what that means. So I think we have different innovations in education. Often technology can support those innovations. There are a few silver bullets in education. The more I learn, the more I realize I don't know. But technology can be a great enhancer of humans. Certainly everything from feedback and assessments to helping people to delivery of content digitally, whether through podcasts mm-hmm. or digital materials, having materials that have feedback in them. Mm-hmm. So again, it used to be if we roll the clock back, you had physical textbooks that couldn't really change, and then sporadic assessments with no feedback. Mm-hmm. So the closer those get together, where technology can help to provide real-time, just-in-time devices with feedback, I think those are certainly pushing the edge.
It's really exciting because if you think about traditionally, somebody had an idea or wanted to contribute to education some way, and they had to wait to go to a publisher or get it adopted at school, and now you're providing them a space. StartEd, like a lot of accelerators and incubators around the country, but you're giving them a place, a credible, highly curated group of folks to help them develop something that's responsive to the market and to the needs. And again, I think that's just an extraordinary thing to be able to say that there are people out there thinking about this and doing this kind of work to improve the way we deliver education and the way people learn.
Yeah, I think that's right. And what we call it an ecosystem, and if you or an ecosystem of innovation, if you look at what Silicon Valley has done so well in technology in general, we've tried to see if we could replicate within education innovation, and that community of innovators, of practitioners, of financiers, of policymakers. Making sure there's a common ground where it's safe for them to connect, because frequently one group looks at the other as the enemy. And education is not just like creating a organization in any other industry. There are very specific cultural issues. There are very specific legal issues. There are very specific privacy issues when you're dealing certainly with children. There are also different social good issues. Let's put it that way. That come into it. So, having a unique community for education innovation, a unique ecosystem, we view as part of the fertile ground to try to develop that army of entrepreneurs.
And before we go on, Jonathan Harbor, what is the best way for people to find out about StartEd if they're interested?
I think www.started.com.
Oh, that's good. That's nice and short, easy to remember. All right, this has been awesome. Final question for you. You talk about an ecosystem. You have a really cool special project that is not entirely directly related to the issue of education, but it is about education because it's about ecology and learning to live differently.
Ah, well, everything's about education. I take it you're I know you've been up to come fishing with me, so I have become very interested in this notion of sustainability and creating whether we can actually create a model environment that could create its own energy, its own food, its own water, its own aquaculture, and also potentially open that up so it could be a learning lab for students. Stay tuned, and as we make more progress, I will. I'm sure you will be there again, and we can report back.
Well, and I think what's really noble about that, as well as a great model, the work you're doing in education, and that you embrace, is that individuals and people can in fact have an impact on these pernicious issues of society, and that you don't expect the government tomorrow to start doing it for us. In fact, just the opposite. Being an entrepreneur and being innovative and finding out solutions or pathways to do things differently oftentimes is on the individual. And I think that's one of those lessons that more and more we have to help people understand.
Yes. And at the end of the day, I guess they say politics is, and government is local. And nothing like starting in your own home and your own backyard as well.
That's exactly right. Jonathan Harbor, entrepreneur, innovator, StartEd accelerator founder, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Jeannie. Great to be here.
Reality Check is a weekly podcast produced in partnership with National Review Online. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe wherever podcasts are available, including iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and Stitcher. And follow us at EdReform on Twitter and myself at Jeannie Allen. For more information or to learn more about the topics you heard today, go to edreform.com.